And now it's time for Chatter on Books from an undisclosed location somewhere near the nation's capital. Here's your host, Tori Clark.
Thanks, Jamie. We are at my favorite undisclosed location where the parking is really, really good. It's such a great commute. Michael is with us. David Aldridge is with us. That was Jamie McIntyre. You heard Claude's doing all the important work. And I'm very excited that we're going to be talking soon with Tom Rosensteel, who we've known each other since we were two in 1988, who's done some amazing things and has a terrific book called Oppo. And if you're sick and tired of everything going on in this town, Washington, D.C., you should read this because it will make you feel better. And it will at least distract you for a while. Right, Tom? We got a few things on tap this evening, some random thoughts, an email for David. David, I'll need your email back.
Yeah,
so I can read it and you can answer it. I have a pop quiz on what celebrity is donating absolutely zillions of books. Michael is going to walk us through the latest and greatest on Station 11. I have a confession. I'm kind of stuck on page 47. And this is why I don't belong to book clubs, because I would have to show up and confess that I'm behind.
I got to 50 before my Kindle died.
There you go. Well, see, that's why you got to get off the Kindle. And then Deserted Island, in honor of what the heck is going on these days, all plagues all the time. Tom, I didn't give you this homework, but you can think about it during the show. So at the end, we do a Deserted Island segment, and we have different themes. And tonight will be if you have a book about plagues or anything like that. But we have to do a coronavirus update, and I want to go around the table, guys.
Yes.
Are you in the... I'm not worried about this at all. I might be washing my hands a little bit more than I used to. I'm in the high state of panic. The world is changing. Which category are you in, Michael?
I'm very nervous about this because I don't trust other people.
And you have small children.
I know my kids' practices, and I know how long they're washing their hands, and I know they can sing certain songs.
Did they sing Happy Birthday or something else?
We sing Happy Birthday. We do a nice jazzy version after we play outside. No, it's
be a little Ozzy Osbourne.
I would say this.
Do they wear little berets when they sing?
The big question right now is we had some travel lined up involved parents, that involved going to see in-laws, and you're trying to be careful, but I don't want this to handicap my life. I'm still more worried. We come from preschool where the teachers are going out with the just regular flu every single day. So that to me is a much realer concern. But we are at a Wegmans. For those of you who are in town, we don't have Wegmans yet. It's coming. But if you go to Northern Virginia, this place is a monster. There was one packet of toilet paper left. And there was absolutely so everyone's been out of Purell and hand sanitizer. I found one in like a different aisle that I was willing to auction off to the highest bidder. But it's amazing. And everyone's embarrassed to admit that they're looking for it. They just keep walking up and down the aisle to see if it's been restocked.
Okay. So I was somewhere today. I won't say where, but I was somewhere today and they had the hand sanitizer up on the counter where you check things out. It wasn't a food store, but up on the counter. And I don't know if
I saw that. I was at Walmart. I'm ready to confess.
You guys don't hang out in the kind of places I hang out, but I'll be in a convenience store in the middle of nowhere, USA, and you need to go and ask for the key for the restroom, you know, those places.
Oh, yeah.
And they put the key on some giant piece of wood you're at a place and they have the pens chained to something so you can't walk away with it.
Don't touch
so
your
they
face.
Had a little cord around the hand sanitizer jar so people wouldn't walk away with it because people have been walking away with their hand sanitizer. David, which camp are you in?
I would not.
Get your hand off your face.
I know. I'm sorry. I was imagining the rest of my 401k going off the cliff like the rest of it did this morning.
So. It will come back. It will come back. Okay.
Like the end of the bridge on the River Kwai. It's unbelievable.
We'll take a 15-minute break to everyone without just the good music. What they've done.
Right. Exactly.
You forgot I needed to be depressed about that.
No, it's fine. It is what it is. I was born poor. I'll die poor. It's okay. It's all right. No, I'm worried because what I'm worried about is that we don't seem to have the slightest idea of what to do as a nation. We don't seem to have any guidance about what to do. If we had people telling us, here's what we're going to do. On Thursday, everybody's going to go to their doctor and get tested, and that's what we're going to do. And you have to take Thursday off and go to your doctor and get tested, and then you'll find out if you have it. That would be fine. It would be an inconvenience, but we'd have a plan. There's no plan. It's the end of Animal House. It's anarchy. There's nothing going on. There's Kevin Bacon saying all as well. There's nothing happening here.
And to Michael's point, again, basic emergency preparedness. People used to say this after 9/11. Just, you know, like my dad lives in a tiny town outside Pittsburgh. The likelihood of terrorists attacking that tiny town, not high, but people were panicking. And what they would say to people, it's just basic emergency preparedness. As if you would prepare if there was a storm, your power got knocked out. You should have some of these supplies on hand. You should have some non-perishables,
right,
those kinds of things. So that's fine. But beating somebody up for the last roll of toilet paper at the Wegmans is not appropriate. Mr. McIntyre, what camp are you in?
So I pride myself on being a rationalist, not an emotionalist, that I think of things rationally and, you know, do the cost-benefit, the risk, the actual risk versus the emotional response. So I'm terrified. No, I'm not terrified. I am terrified of the response that we're going to get from all the people who are terrified. So, you know, like, I'm also watching my 401k become a 201k and a 101k. I know.
And a minus K.
You said, you know, it's going to come back. And I said, my rational side says, you know, it will come back and I don't need the money now. And I remember what happened every other time the market crashed and people panicked and pulled their money out, how they all regretted it later. And I'm thinking to myself, so, I have a bunch of cash sitting in a really low interest CD. And if I really believed what I'm telling other people, I would take that money and I'd put it in the market now or next week,
yes,
or whenever, because, you know, I can perfectly time the market. But of course I don't, because, you know, why throw good money after bad? Because basically we are emotional creatures. We react to emotion,
right,
and we are influenced by the activity of people around us. Mm-hmm. So when I went to my local grocery store and I saw people buying carts of water, of, like, you know, the 24 case,
yeah,
of bottled water, and they've got three or four of them stacked up in their cart, and they're buying them. I'm thinking, what they think it's going to get, the virus is going to get in the water. They think the water supply is going to be turned off. I don't know. I should just buy some. Everybody else is doing it.
Right.
Okay. I don't want to scare people, but if you were a bad guy out there trying to stir all this trouble up and you really wanted to do harm, one could get into the water system. Isn't that something you would do if you were truly a bad guy who might live in some place like
Russia?
Are you trying
to make it worse? It's not bad enough already.
Okay, basic emergency preparedness. That's what I'm saying. Remember Y2K when we thought, sure, all right? I was pretty confident the ATMs would be out for months. And so I just kept taking cash at the ATMs. And swear to God, if I get hit by a bus, the first thing you want to do is run into the undisclosed location and just start pulling all the books off the bookshelves. Because I don't remember which books, but there was money hidden in books in these walls. Right?
There's always money in the banana stand.
Just in case the cops come.
Okay. Well, we'll see where
we
are.
Do you think the money's going to be any good? You'll be like throwing $100 bills at people.
Yeah, we'll need a wheelbarrow with thousands and thousands of those things. Yeah. Very practically speaking, I did have someone lined up for this show for next week who is a plague expert. And the good news, bad news is he's very busy and had to beg off. And the good news is because they want him working on important things, which is good. So fingers crossed. Prepare for the worst, hope for the best. Okay, David, are you ready for your email?
Ask away.
Okay, it's really short and simple. This is Tom from Worcester. It's misspelled. Worcester. Dear Chatter, I can't do accents. I am a TK Little and new to Chatter on Books. We have a lot of those, thank goodness. And a total David Aldridge groupie. Who isn't?
Oh, stop.
If he could write about one athlete, dead or alive, who would it be?
Oh,
but this is the pressure, I think, here is, because the way it was underlined, you can only write one book about one athlete for your entire life. So choose carefully.
For my entire life?
Yeah.
Wow.
Choose carefully.
That is a good question.
It's a commitment.
Well, lots of people have written about Muhammad Ali, so that's probably out. I don't think there's a whole lot of new areas to mine there. Can I write about a thing as opposed to a person,
sure,
a sports,
sure,
thing?
Are you authorized to change the emailer's question?
Yes,
sure.
Absolutely. It's,
yeah,
her,
checking,
show. It's her show. This actually is, I'm giving away one of my book ideas, to the general public. So general public, do not write a book about this because I'm going to,
well, let them write it and then we sue them and,
yeah, exactly,
easy way to make some money.
I want to write a book about a meeting that took place in 1967, mm-hmm, in Cleveland, Ohio, in which the following people took part, I should say. Muhammad Ali was there. Jim Brown was there. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was there. Bobby Mitchell, who was very familiar with Washington football people, he was the first African-American to play for the Redskins, was there. Essentially, every every African American athlete of any stature was at this meeting. And the basic premise of this meeting was to show support for Muhammad Ali, who did not want to enlist in the army.
Right.
Did not want to go to Vietnam, and did so on religious grounds. He was a Muslim. He said, "We do not fight in wars unless we're directed to by the Quran or by our religion." And he certainly was not directed to fight in Vietnam for the United States. And they basically said, "We're here because we want to support Muhammad Ali, and he's allowed to do whatever he wants to do." I think it's the most fascinating collection of athletes together for a single reason in the history of the world.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. So I've always wanted to write a book about that. Unfortunately, Muhammad Ali passed away, and a lot of they're all getting up there. So I got to hurry if I'm going to get this done. But that is something I would love to write about, that meeting.
I think you should do it.
Yeah.
And now the 401k's done. We're going to be looking for somebody.
Earn a little scratch.
Or sometimes when you say to people now, you should write a book about that. And it's like, as Tom Rosenstiel, who we'll be talking to soon, knows, because he's written several, it's hard work. Just do a Netflix series, David. Just go straight to Netflix.
Just
nice six-part series. Yeah. Good quality work that way.
I was amazed. Okay. If you ever pick up the any screenplays from any of the successful movies and you read the screenplays, a number of words, how few there are in a two-hour movie.
Yeah.
And how much is left to the director to fill in.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the scene will say, and Tori walks into a room and has a discussion with her fellow podcast members. And that's all it says. And then everybody has to fill that in.
They improvise.
But it's, I would
And then
say
the directors get credited with this incredible creative genius. And all they did was say, here's the scene. You guys now start talking. We could do that.
But my point is, I guess, that I'm not sure that writing the screenplay would be any easier. In fact, it might be harder than actually writing the book.
Okay, don't discourage David.
No, please.
We're keen on that.
Discourage so I don't do it.
Okay, now to the to Michael and our virtual book club. And I am just feeling anxious and all those bad vibes of grade school coming back to me when I didn't have the work done. Now it's Monday. I didn't do the homework. I didn't read the book. I'm kind of stuck.
Well, don't worry. I didn't plan anything for this. No, so I want to know why. What was the sort of the block that came to you? Was it about the actual reading? Was it content based on how
you just literally ran out of time?
Okay, well to me that's different than say I put the book down because it was confusing or it's not relevant to me.
Mm-hmm. No, I kept reading a few pages. This is Stations 11, Tom.
Station 11.
I don't know why I keep
you
saying
get better
plural.
Every week though.
Yeah, I don't know why I keep saying station.
At least this week you spelled out 11 versus just using the number.
Yeah.
That,
but
it fits.
I read a few pages and it scares me and I put it down. Then I read a few pages and it scares me more.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I would say I feel so bad that I picked this. I didn't know things would escalate this quickly.
It really was. What? You really did pick it months ago.
I think, but it is prescient. That means that we're on top of things here.
So for today's activity, I'm just going to read a little bit of a section. This is still relevant to where you are, but we are now in the post-collapse world.
Right.
We're still following the little girl who is on stage when this famous celebrity dies. And again, there's a couple of parallel storylines in terms of what would be the present when this is happening, when it's sort of fast forward into the 20 years later, as we see this young woman as part of a traveling group that is performing Shakespeare on the road as they're trying to add some culture, trying to find some sense of community. And then we've started to go back in time to learn more about the celebrity. I'm less important with that, but I want to start with Kirsten. So we're going to go to page 50. And our action
at
page 40. So we're still good for you.
David's there.
Yes.
David made it.
When Kirsten was in the houses, she searched for celebrity gossip magazines because once, when she was 16 years old, she flipped through a magazine on a dust blackened side table and found her past. And it's just a little graph about Arthur Leander, the celebrity that worked with her the day that this pandemic started. She saw him die on stage during the production of King Lear. The photograph, Arthur with a three-day beard, rumpled clothes, a baseball cap, carrying a small boy who beamed up at his father's face while Arthur smiled at the camera. The Georgia flu would arrive in a year. "I knew him," she told August, breathless. "He gave me the comics I showed you." And August had nodded and asked to see the comics again. There were countless things about the pre-collapse world that Kirsten couldn't remember. Her street address, her mother's face, the TV shows that August never stopped talking about. But she did remember Arthur Leander, and after that first sighting, she went through every magazine she could find in search of him. She collected fragments stored in a Ziploc bag in her backpack, a picture of Arthur alone on a beach looking pensive and out of shape. a picture of him with his wife, Miranda, and then later with his second wife. Again, we get into a list here. I'm going to pause because I think we're getting the point. But we ended last week by my asking you to start thinking about the characterization, and we're going to start with her, this young woman. What does it say that she's collecting fragments? Here we see it as a list that is growing. She's accumulating stuff. In this interesting sort of parallel to the pre-collapse world, she's building a collection of junk, of detritus, but at the same time, it is anchoring her to her past. Remember David talking about, well, why would you want to perform? What does that sense of normalcy give you? What does that sense of community give you? What is that sense of having that common purpose, but also finding some sense of hope maybe in that art? And here, we see her going back and creating greater connections to this past, to that one night that's in her mind, but is just sort of a blurry vision at this point. And it's very telling as we go forward and we see people asking, well, do you remember air conditioning? Mm-hmm. Or do you remember electricity? Or do you remember the internet? And they're just standing. You mean you could just Google anything? So I'm interested in how we develop more of her character, that she's holding on to this stuff. Is there going to be a moment when she wants to let it go, when she has to let it go, when she has to move past those anchors that are holding her back to that night? What is that building her up to? Again, what do we know that she's missed in this 20-year period? We've missed sort of her becoming a woman, a fully formed adult, except in this post-collapse world on the road. There are a lot of milestones. You're talking birthdays, high school graduations, parties, first loves. Love comes into play in some of this, mm-hmm. but it's an affected version of that that is different than what could have been. I also think it's interesting as we go through this and we think about our own society right now, what is the anthropological effect of studying the past through these cutouts of gossip magazines? At a certain point, we hate our obsession with celebrity culture, but if we were to say pause right now and go to our Us Weeklies and our OK magazines and pull out all the fragments about Sussex royals and whomever, is that not giving us a more accurate depiction of what's on our minds, what we're all talking about? So as we go forward, I want us to start to think about life as stage. Again, Shakespeare's mm-hmm. important to this. We always come back to out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. And again, we open with the theater. So for us, as we move into that world, I sort of want to think about how we're actually getting a real glimpse. We're no longer seeing just the stage version. We're actually getting glimpses into that through the letters that you're going to start reading about as you go forward.
Excellent. David, any thoughts?
The thing that I was taken by in the first, 50 or so pages was the sense that all of the protagonists are extremely isolated to begin with. The young man that performs CPR on the dying Arthur is completely alienated from his live-in girlfriend. When he finds out about the pandemic, he kind of hems and haws and delays and then finally calls her and can't get her to focus on it. But he does it kind of half-heartedly. He's much more interested in getting to his brother's apartment, right? This actress, the young lady who was six and is now an adult, is traveling and living on fragments of memory. She's completely isolated from her past, from her family. The girlfriend of Arthur, or one of the wives of Arthur, who is in Indonesia or Jakarta or something, when she's informed that he died, is completely cut off from the rest of the world when she finds out. And this is the man she thought she was going to spend the rest of her life with.
Yeah.
Turns out, no, she didn't. And no, she's not. And so I'm curious as we go forward if that question of individual isolation is going to continue to be central to many of the main protagonists in the story, that they are all cut off from civilization, because what is a pandemic other than cutting everyone off from everybody else? I mean, that's one of the main issues with the pandemic, is that you are isolated. You have to get on with your life in some new form, pretty much on your own. You don't have the luxury of being able to communicate with other people around the world to see how they're doing. You have to kind of do it on your own. And I just wonder if that's going to be a constant.
I think we can watch that, but if you take a look at this, and again, you're thinking about that problem continues post-collapse and you're thinking, well, it makes sense then. But that is a very modern, very human problem, as to think about all the access, all the power you had, yet we were still going into these isolated selves. Is that true just to say our modern, I would say American, but it is worldwide, but that sort of modern sense of pushing forward? And what will happen in that post-collapse world if they find a way to come together, mm-hmm. if there are certain geographical spaces or mindsets that bring them together? Or what if there are other forces in the book that want to try and prey on that sense of isolation and see how they can use that? It's not necessarily monetized, but it's how they can control the situation if they come in as the pariah, mm-hmm. and they're trying to set the terms as to how we might be able to engage with each other.
Jamie just coughed. Get out of the house. Okay, Michael, so I have one thought and then one question to get us out of this. The thought is, listening to you talk about this book in up to page 37 and listening to the exchange you and David just had, I keep going back. Okay, 47. Remember Anne Hornaday's book on the movies?
Yeah.
Just a remarkable book. And I'm reading it going, she is so smart. And I go to a lot of movies and I watch a lot of movies. I had no idea all these things were going on in these movies. She would be talking about movies I've seen. And I thought, wow, I must have been eating the popcorn and had no idea. There's so much more going on than I am usually aware. And so listening to you talk about this, it's stunning. Because I go, okay, I should slow down and read more carefully.
I would visualize. I think this is a very visual book, and yeah. I think it plays a lot into the idea that
I've got the Netflix series ready to go.
Drama is inherent to this story. So I would imagine that you actually are trying to run a camera and produce these shots in your mind's eye.
Yeah, I do that.
Just to pick up on what you're saying. So I have a favorite classic Peanuts cartoon, and which Charlie Brown and Linus and Lucy are lying on their backs and they're looking up the clouds, and Lucy asks, what do you see in the clouds? And Linus says something like, well, that cloud there looks like the stoning of St. Stephen's. And you can see the little cross in the background. Of course, Charlie Brown says, well, I was just going to say, I see a duck and a bunny, but
yeah,
I'm kind of in the duck and the bunny mode.
Yeah, I'm generally in the duck and bunny mode. But yes. It is true. The reading I've done on this and then a couple things that we've talked about recently, I can see it. I can absolutely see how something might transpire. So what's next? What should we be prepared for next time?
Oh, we're going to continue with this idea of the stage. We're in another house scene later, but why don't you just get a little
meander
bit deeper
along
into the book?
Yeah.
And I'll try and just play off of where you are.
I've got some travel coming up because I'm not afraid of coronavirus, darn it. So I'll be reading it then. Okay, we got to do Calvert Woodley and then we'll take a break and come back with Tom. And Michael, I'm going to have you read because I have so butchered the names. The guys at Calvert Woodley this morning said to me, you have to work on your pronunciation.
You just got
to
read it quickly.
That in front of you. I can talk about it, but... So Calvert Woodley, our wonderful sponsor.
Of course you choose something that I have zero chance to pronounce correctly.
It's Italian. You can do it.
We are enjoying the Montepulciano di Abruzzo.
Perfect. Sounds very, very nice. It's a red. It's lovely. Stephen at Calvert Woodley was very excited about this. He called it a pretty wine, which seems like high praise. It gets a 94. Not too many wines get a 94. And I can't remember the price, but they're selling it at a very reasonable price. And it's lovely. David, you've had a little. You need some more. Jamie, can you help David out with that?
I already finished the bottle here. I'm taking it home with me.
Yeah. And then Ibrahim in La Cheeserie. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing better than being in Calvert Woodley and you hear somebody come on the loudspeaker and say, La Cheeserie, line 3. Yes, I love that. A Pecorino Toscano. 3 months old, sheep's milk, which is Ibrahim's favorite. Yes. The running joke at Calvert Woodley is that he puts sheep's milk on his cereal in the morning. No jaunty beret today, but he says hi to everybody. So it's terrific. And I say it all the time. They have the greatest, most knowledgeable staff, and you can tell them what you're doing, and they'll pick a great wine, and then you show Ibrahim and the guys at La Cheeserie your wine, and they pick you a great cheese. Michael, have you had any of the cheese?
I tried just a little bit. I'm just looking up the region. This is going to be just southeast of Florence.
It's very good.
Still can get to Florence,
still
right?
Still can get there, yeah. It might be flying to Rome and sort of see what happens.
Okay, let's take a break and then we will come back with Tom.
We're back with Chatter on Books. Here's Tori Clark.
That was so quick, I wasn't ready. Thanks, Jamie. Okay, we are back. It's Chatter on Books. Tom, I promise at some point we're going to talk to you. I should have warned you. You know, we say this show is ostensibly about books, but it's about lots of other things. Speaking of, David, update on the AU women playing as we speak.
As we speak.
Who are they playing?
I'm sorry. Playing Boston University.
Ooh, probably
pretty. Quarterfinals of the Patriot League tournament.
Right.
They are down by 3 points with about 2.5 minutes to go.
So,
first half.
So it's anybody's game.
It's anybody's game. It's early.
So far. Their season, how's it been?
Not awful. Not great.
Are we happy about, Jamie, you're the Maryland guy. Are we happy about the Maryland men and women?
Absolutely. But, you know, isn't it true with college basketball, or really any basketball, that you could really just wait till the last minute of the game and watch it then and have all the same excitement, but in a much shorter period?
I should not even think about interrupting David, my vast professional sports fan experience. I think that's very true about professional sports, but not college, right, David?
I think it's sort of a cliche.
Yeah.
Because a lot of games are actually lost in the first quarter. Well, one in the first quarter.
My beloved Florida Gators were playing University of Kentucky the other day.
The Wildcats.
Yesterday.
Yes.
And they were leading the entire game. All the way to the very last, like, 26 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lost.
Well, that does happen, but not all the time.
But if the game is close, if it's within 6 points, when it gets into the last minute, you know, that's when the game is won.
Right. Well, there's some truth to that.
Keeping our coronavirus theme going, we are very hopeful that March Madness does get to go on as planned and that fans get to sit in the stands, Michael shaking, going, I'm not going.
Imagine the changeover from game one to game two.
Imagine the locker rooms. Ooh.
Yes.
Okay, Tom, you here to talk to us about sports tonight?
I'll talk about that. I mean, when you're peddling a book, you'll talk about anything.
Anything. Right. Favorite college team?
Probably Stanford.
Nice. There Cardinal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Cardinal used to be something else.
Indians.
That's right.
The
but
Indians.
They were ahead of others in changing that name.
And
right?
There was a big argument because they didn't call themselves the Cardinals. They called themselves the Cardinal.
Yeah.
And people said, why shouldn't this be plural? Aren't there more? Isn't there more than one person on the team? And they said, it's a collective noun.
Oh,
nice.
I thought it was the color.
It's the color, but if that's a collective noun. So even though there's 11 players on the team, they're all the Cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
But then the image is a tree.
Correct.
None of it makes sense.
Yeah, well, that's the Stanford.
Let's just make things more complicated than it needs to be. Yeah.
It is a beautiful campus, though. It is gorgeous.
There's nothing red on the tree.
Right.
There's no bird in the tree.
Our favorite bartender, who is not here, went to business school there. And the great scam of Stanford Business School is it is relatively hard to get in. Mm-hmm. And once you get in, it is the biggest freaking joke you have ever encountered in your life. Because, first of all, no grades. That's like too icky. If they work on anything, they work on things on a project, team basis. They all work on it together, which means nobody really works on it. And they spend an extraordinary amount of time drinking really good wine in Northern California.
Yeah, I'm sensing a little professional
resentment.
Resentment here.
I was 10 at the time, but I was working for the U.S. Trade rep at the time, Carla Hills, who Tom knew. And I would be working, we all worked around the clock. And I'd be sitting in my office down there, downtown, right across the street from the White House. And it'd be 11:30 at night, and I'd be working, and I was happily working. It was a great job. And Brian and his pals would call from a hot tub in Northern California. We're killing ourselves here at Stanford B School. And then, but the curse of going to school at Stanford is people spend the rest of their lives wishing they were back at Stanford. That's what happens.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my wife went to got accepted to law school there and said, if I come here, I'll never leave.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go here.
He and all his buddies, they still spend just amazing amount of time just kind of circling around, wishing they could be back there. Okay, Tom, thank you for being with us.
Go to stanford.edu. You too can have the Stanford life.
he had choices and he went there. I had an influence on that. Okay, Tom, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to talk about lots of things. We're going to talk about your fabulous book, Oppo. I mean it. If you're sick and tired of what is going on in this town these days, and who isn't, this is a really, really fun, terrific book to read. But we have kind of standard get in questions here and get out. Less standard get out. But the get in question is, what did you want to be when you were five?
Who can remember five, even at our young age?
Exactly.
I do remember in the sixth grade, somebody, they asked us what you were going to be. And I, for some reason, I said a golf course architect and a writer.
Michael's so excited.
Boom!
That's his answer. Well, I'm sorry, the combination. Go ahead. Golf course.
People always said to me, even early on, oh, well, you'll be a writer. When I was a little kid, people would say that to me.
I'm going to turn the mic over to Michael. Michael, greater future in golf course design or writing?
Separate. Right now we're in the renaissance of golf course architecture and the conversation around it. And you're looking at the career of Jeff Shackelford, who is looking at how you can do both right now in this modern age. I'm so excited you mentioned golf course architecture. All right, I'm out.
Now, I will say, from what I can tell, golf course, I can't even pronounce it, golf course architecture is the art of making people's lives miserable.
Speaking of, so you golf, obviously. Yeah. So Michael and I have been talking for a few weeks about doing a show the run up to the Masters. So I go to my friend Mr. Google and I type in books about golf. Now, Nora, if you typed in books about basketball or books about business or books about plagues, you get a variety of things. In basketball, you get things about teams, you get things about great tournaments, you get books about individuals, you get just a nice panoply of lots of different ways of looking at a particular topic. You Google books about golf, you know, how I survived the angst of golf, right? How not to kill yourself learning how to play golf. It's the most angst-ridden category. It's remarkable. Are you a good golfer?
I spend a lot of time writing now, so my golf, but I got good. I got good.
Okay, good. So you have a long, very, very good career because you started when you were two in journalism and what I would call the serious side of journalism. And media critic when it really meant something to be a media critic. And you get involved with things like Pew and the American Press Institute because you care about journalism and the First Amendment and things like that, which is great. But you've turned to fiction. What precipitated the turn?
It's a really interesting question because my answer has changed as I've gone further into fiction. When I was as a writer, David, you know, everybody who can write a little thinks when they read thrillers, I could write one of these. Sure. I'd like to write one of these. There probably isn't
so
any
easy.
Journalist who hasn't had that fantasy. And I wrote a terrible book when I was about 29 that is in a drawer. I don't even know where the drawer is. And the book is in it. And then I had kids, got married, had kids, dreamed up a and it was terrible, that novel, as I've found out every first novel is. So my kids got into high school, I had more time, and, you know, I wrote 7 nonfiction books in the interim because there was an extension of my journalism. And it just came back to me when I had time, and I was unhappy at my job at that moment, which I've also found out is kind of an origin story for writing fiction. Mm-hmm. And I needed something that was an emotional release that would make me feel that my creative energy was being well spent. I'm on my 4th book now. Oppo is my 3rd, and my answer has changed. I realized that as a journalist, I was a political journalist, and I wrote about media. You can't get as close to the story anymore as you once did. And I remember a guy, Barry Barak, who called me up, who was a reporter for the LA Times with me, and said, we've crossed some kind of Rubicon. It was about 1990, 1989. Mm-hmm. And I said, what Rubicon? He said, and Barry was covered all kinds of airline crashes. And he said, I used to be able to walk the crash site with the NTSB investigator. Now there are so many journalists here. We're just cordoned off behind a rope. All the communications is in press conferences. And my sources, who I know really well, are not allowed to talk to me. Mm-hmm. Partly because other reporters get mad and talk to the communications guy if I have special access. And I just think that's grown. We've just gone for a whole bunch of reasons since then. And I realized that to write about why politics seems broken, I need to be in the hearts of my characters. And I don't know, as a journalist, the people well enough anymore. They won't let their hair down on either side. well enough for me to know their motivations. Mm-hmm. Even in the 90s, you know, John Kasich was a guy who would tell you everything about what he was thinking. And I don't think he would do that now. And if
right.
he did, he would get
much
in trouble
more careful. Yeah. Much more careful. Jamie David, same experience?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's do athletes first because we love athletes. And then we'll go to public officials.
It's about the same time frame, actually. Early 90s is when it started to really shut down. Yeah. Used to be able to go to guys' houses, come to the house, hang out with them, you know, get to know them a little. You don't get to know anybody really well, but a little bit.
Right.
A little bit more informed, or at least you could spend time with them. Go to lunch with them or go to sit with them at their locker for 45 minutes and really get into something, you know. But you, that just started to go away.
And now it's snippets. Jamie?
So, I mean, we've seen this trend over the years. You know, for me, it kind of crystallized, if you pardon the pun, with the Rolling Stone profile of Stanley McChrystal. I forget what it's called. Runaway General or something.
Yeah, right.
By the so where a lot of the stuff where that was off the record or just sort of people laying their head down in private, you know, was all laid out there by a reporter who didn't have any particular need to have these sources later in the future. And it was a really damaging article in a number of ways. First of all, it ended Stanley McChrystal's career, but it also created this impression that reporters, you know, cover up, you know, significant things and they trade that for access, which is not my experience, but it created that impression, which is a really damaging thing. And when you start talking about as we move into the age of so-called fake news, where everyone's credibility is questioned, you know, it starts with that kind of erosion of trust between reporters and the people that they cover. I always said, as being a Pentagon reporter, that the most difficult part of the job was having the respect of the people you cover and the people that you work for, because usually you had one or the other. Like, you know, your editors would think that you weren't aggressive enough, but the people you covered would think you were a really good reporter who kept things in perspective. Mm-hmm. Or you had the opposite thing where the people that you covered thought you were an arrogant, agenda-driven weasel, but your editors thought you were doing a terrific job.
Yeah.
And so to have that balance between the two is really difficult, and I think it's almost impossible today.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Okay, so I just have flashbacks. When Jamie's telling these stories at the Pentagon, working for Rumsfeld, Jamie in the front row, and long story short, after X number of briefings, Rumsfeld and I are walking back to his office, and he says, "That Jamie McIntyre, he seems like such a nice young man." And I said, "Oh, he's a nice young man." And he goes, "Why is he such a pain in the fill in the blank in the press briefings?" And I said, "Because his bosses are watching. And if he doesn't ask," I called them barky little questions. "If he doesn't ask barky little questions, then his bosses will be mad for him." And Rumsfeld kind of took it on board, went, "Oh, okay." And he was fine with that. Okay, so Tom, I'm going to read you something. Yeah. This is a quote from you. You're talking about this, about writing fiction. "The more fiction I write, the more I recognize how much made up stories are a shared effort." What does that mean?
So when I was in the newspaper business, your whole goal was to write your story so cleanly that your editor didn't touch it.
Right.
How often did you succeed?
A lot, because I knew grammar, I knew sentence structure, and you know.
Who gets the credit for your grammar, your sentence structure? Because you are very articulate.
My mother was an English teacher, and my first editor made me memorize Strunk and White.
The best book ever.
But the old reporter's trick was to put one graph in that was obviously superfluous and sort of slightly overwritten. So
no.
They could take it out.
Absolutely.
So that they would feel like did something.
Absolutely.
Because let them worry about the, you know, let them worry about the guy across the room whose stuff is terrible. They're like, let's wave this on through because I've got other stuff I've got to deal with. And in fiction, it's not true. First of all, you know, it's 80, 90,000 words. You can't even remember characters' names that you started with. You need help. And the other thing, you were talking about how the impression you get from a book versus the impression somebody else does.
Because Michael is smart and I am not. That's a big
talk
part
about
of the
smart,
impression.
Man, that guy really is articulate. You also, when you're writing a book, you realize what you're trying to do is create an emotional response in the reader And your response, Jamie, is going to be different than David's. And you, as the writer, really don't have any control over that. You're creating stimuli, but you don't actually know what everybody's experience is. So it's not as though you're missing something in the mm-hmm. movie. Mm-hmm. You're just having, you're watching your movie.
Yeah. I'm eating a lot, too. That's very distracting.
Well, so you're multitasking.
Yes. Yeah.
Isn't it just a well-known fact that you can get closer to the truth with fiction than you can with the limits
yeah,
of...
Yeah, but I think listening to all three of it, I find this fascinating. There's a reason you're shifting to fiction. You want to achieve the same thing. Is how well can I tell a story, an important story? How well can I help people understand this character? But the way things have gotten these days with journalists and the people they cover, that has become less and less likely.
Well, I also think journalism, you know, is on firmer footing when it's writing about the physical externals, the externalities of something. What did he say? How many people were in the mm-hmm. room? How many people died? You know, the more you go into why did that accident happen? What is David's motivation? You're on softer ground and you need to do even deeper reporting.
Right.
And when you're writing fiction, you're not just writing what happened, what was the action, you're also writing about what did it feel like to be there. So if I were interviewing somebody for fiction, I would say, well, what did you think when you said that to that guy? In this book, I did research. I asked people, political consultants, about opposition research that they've done, which is what OPPO stands for, mm-hmm. as we all know. And people told me the stories about telling a client, you've got to resign from the Senate. What you've done is so terrible. And if I'd asked them as a reporter, how did you feel when you said that, they would have said, that's none of your effing business.
Yes. Right.
But when I'm doing fiction research, that not only is that a really interesting question for them, it's one they'd never been asked before.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe by their, you know, friends.
Speaking of questions that haven't been asked, can you just tell us like a little bit about what the book's about? I know it's crazy ask that. But,
I always forget that.
So the book takes place during this election year, what would be 2020 in my
fiction world. Kind of frighteningly, Lee, so.
There's a moderate senator, a woman from Arizona, an invented character, who gets a call one afternoon at the height of the primaries, asking her if she would consider consider the vice presidency from a candidate in the other party. And she and her chief of staff discuss this for an hour or so. They're kind of, you know, shocked by this. It would be political suicide to do it.
Sure.
And then hour later,
even though John McCain considered it.
He sure did.
Lieberman was going to do it.
Yeah. An hour later, she gets a call from somebody in her own party asking her if she would consider the vice presidency. And she's even more shocked because now she has two offers in one day from competing from both parties. And the next day, she gets a call from her chief fundraiser saying, I just got a call from somebody who was passing along a call from somebody else who said, if you accept the vice presidency, they have something on you that will destroy you. And she says, who called you? And he said, I don't even know, and I didn't ask. Are you considering the vice presidency? She calls in my main characters, who are political operatives, who are assigned, who have the task of finding out who is threatening her and with what. And she claims not to know. So that's the setup for the book.
It takes really
place
fun.
In a week. They have about a week to figure it out.
It's really fun, and you're reading, and again, Tom and I have known each other for 1,000 years, but as I'm reading it, I go, okay, that could have been so-and-so. I don't do I usually do the Netflix series in my head, which this would be a great Netflix series. What wouldn't? But then I start going, oh, that could have been an idea you pulled from. Again. How many of the ideas or the characters in this book did you pull from people you have covered over the years or watched over the years?
That's a good question that I don't know the answer to because you're imagining this character, mm-hmm. but you're inevitably drawing on things you know. The Capitol doesn't blow up in my books. there aren't hidden assassins and all that. They're designed to be super plausible. And so even more so, I'm drawing on real people. But you do, when you write thrillers, you take a situation and you say, okay, what could go wrong here?
Right.
And you just play that out. So one of the things that I imagined might happen in this book was that the person who's threatening her has hired a firm like Black Cube which is ex-spies. Now, opposition research, it means I'm going to look at your past like mm-hmm. a cop. I'm going to go find out what had happened in your past. Mm-hmm. Spies use other techniques. They will create situations. They will use honey traps and other things to snare you into something and then use that against you. Well, guess what? The New York Times did a story yesterday about Eric Prince
mm-hmm.
hiring spies exactly. to train right. people to infiltrate right. and ensnare.
Right. Yeah.
And one of the things that these guys in the book say is, oh my gosh, the techniques of espionage are coming into politics
yeah.
in a way that they haven't been before.
So to read a line from Tom's terrific book, Oppo, Campaign Events LLC was a firm, and let me back up. When Tom and I first knew each other, when we were two, opposition research was you were running against, okay, John McCain, you're running against a guy, I swear to God, his name was Richard Kimball, and you would go to the Phoenix Library to microfiche, and you'd look up to see if there were any articles that ever written about him,
right.
and that was it. Right? Right, and the worst thing they could say about him was he was Robert Redford lookalike. Like, wow, bummer. So much for opposition research.
And if you thought there was something really bad, you might hire a private detective to nose around.
No, not back then. But no, not was, back then.
Was, you had to think
or
there
you'd
was
follow Gary like Hart around in Miami.
One exactly. Okay, so back to Oppo by Tom Rosenstiel. If we like you, we mention your book's name all
yeah.
Campaign Events LLC was a firm that specialized in organizing counter-protests and other disruptive political activities. If someone wanted to infiltrate an opposing political organization, or disrupt a protest, or stage a counter-protest, Campaign Events would oblige. Can't we substitute Russia for Campaign Events LLC?
Yeah. And probably domestic firms, too.
Yeah.
I mean, people are learning, the bad guys are learning from Russia.
Right. And I keep, the word sophistication keeps coming to mind, and I hate that because it's too positive a connotation. But it is getting, with campaigns, it is getting to this level, right?
Yeah. You know, when we were doing it, I remember talking to Lee Atwater in 88 and saying, why do you have, you know, why is George Bush running on things like the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yeah.
You know, he's a substantive guy. Why are the issues in his ads not more serious? And Lee said, you know, the ad is 30 seconds. What can you convey? But if I show these images, they are triggers for all kinds of deeper associations that people have
mm-hmm.
About the cultural changes in America, the Vietnam War. This is 88, so all of that is still present. But George Bush was responsible for these ads, and
mm-hmm.
and you know they were an extension of him. Now you go into social media, and it's they are triggers. They are things that are designed not to make you want to support George Bush and not vote for Mike Dukakis, but make you want to hate people.
Right.
And I mean, they're designed.
The Atlantic just wrote this huge story about it. It's all about hate now.
Yeah.
I hate
inciting
that guy.
Hatred.
Yeah.
Right. The internet is the flip side of the internet, which is designed to figure out how to sell targeted advertising. What ads will, how are you different than David? And so what ads should I show you? The flip side of that is people using the same architecture to divide us politically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The yep. same targeting used kind of in the other way.
Right. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a writer's question. Because you mentioned earlier that all journalists have this fantasy that they're going to write a thriller. Like, maybe I thought of it once.
Yeah.
Jamie's got a few copies
maybe
in the back of his car out
of
there.
A book proposal, but I never actually wrote it. So my question is, so is there a thriller author that sort of influenced you
excellent
or that
question.
you really like? And the other thing is, were you worried that you might be influenced by the writing style of someone else who you admired in writing a thriller?
Yeah, great questions, both. Actually, the writers who I really liked before I got started on this were tended to be Europeans. Mm-hmm. Henning Mankell is a Swedish writer who writes these books that were enormously popular about a detective named Willander who
has
it's a lot of angst in these books about,
and it's always dark and rainy.
It's dark and rainy.
Dark
another is Ian Rankin. Ian Rankin is a Scottish writer mm-hmm. and He's still going, and probably really became big in the late 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And these books are, his character is, are pretty damaged and, is always on the brink of being fired and was really a kind of, updating of noir, but with a, Ian always wants to write about sort of social issues through the lens of a thriller.
Yeah. Well, if you admire these people, how do you push that aside when you're trying to find your own style?
So what I don't, so it's a great question because whatever you're reading ends up on the page a little bit, especially when you're an immature writer, which I would say I certainly was in my first couple books. One thing I do is I don't read in my genre when I'm writing. I don't read political type stories. Right. I don't read other people who are doing that. And I try and read, I try and make it, I switch it up. So that I'm not just reading, you know, hard-boiled. I'll read a literary novel that's not a thriller, and then I'll read a thriller, and then I'll, and I try and read enough out of my space that when I go through the book later, I can create, I can get rid of that. And eventually you get your own voice. I don't know if I've got it
that's
yet.
Awesome. So speaking of, what's next? Everyone should get Oppo. And by the way, I was traveling a lot this weekend, and there, you go through all these airports. I was in the Houston airport, a little less busy than it was a week ago.
Yeah.
And I left a copy of Oppo. I go into bookstores and airports now, and I'll leave a copy of the book of our featured author coming in the airport bookstore. Yeah. And I just put it there and just think somebody, you know, I don't know if they, you got paid for it, but I'm sure somebody picked it up. But what's next?
So the fourth book, which might be the last in the series, we'll see, is the same characters, and it's called Ask Not. And it's about the launching of a new presidency. And if you imagine that you're the president in this kind of an atmosphere, and you want to try and heal the system, how would you do it? If you almost imagine it as a startup.
Excellent, excellent segue.
Has there been a Hollywood movie contract signed yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
There will be. There will be. And the rule is if you are on Chatter and Books and you get that Hollywood movie, we all get invited to premiere.
Absolutely.
And in the good seats, not the ones right up front.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, here's your get-out question. Given everything you've seen and covered and now written, but the world in general, are you optimistic or pessimistic and why? Oh, he's pausing. That's a bad sign.
I am a lot more can I take a cut, do over?
Yeah.
I'm a lot more optimistic today than I was 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
Because
the Democratic Party has coalesced around a candidate who could actually win.
Yeah.
They all woke up, smacked themselves in the face, and said, "What are we doing?"
Hit ourselves with a board.
And because the other reason I'm a little bit optimistic is, you know, we in the news business think the future is going to be like the past, only more so. That all the things we've seen are help us and provide us with expertise. And all of last year I said, you know, if Joe Biden starts winning primaries, you won't think he's so cognitively impaired.
Yeah.
And as I got closer to the event, I thought, oh, no, I'm wrong. But so I'm a little bit glad that that expertise, because we saw it with George Bush, right?
Yeah.
Well behind in 88. And then it's almost like going to the eye doctor and someone starts to perform and kind of hit their pace. And suddenly it's like they say, is it this one or that one? And suddenly it's in focus and you can see that person more clearly or the way they want to be seen. And for the moment, we'll see the show. I don't know when the show runs, but, you know, it could, but I think that's happened. And I also think, that the coronavirus and the economy are nonpartisan issues. And people will begin to just sort of view this as something very personal. And that is actually, weirdly, crises unify us as a country.
Yeah,
and we need that.
Coronavirus could be a big one. Could be. We hope not. Tom Rosenstiel, the book is Oppo. It's fabulous. Everyone should get this. What's coming up? What holidays are coming up? St. Patrick's Day. It's a great St. Patrick's Day gift. It is a great St. Patrick's Day. Okay, so now we'll go to deserted. David, do we have an AU update?
I think they're down two. I'm not sure.
That's good. They're keeping it close. Awesome. Close. Okay. So deserted island, all plagues, all the time. Michael did have to go because he had to wash the babies, which we strongly support, especially in this time. Interesting. Tony Kornheiser has phenomenal handwriting. Have you ever seen his handwriting?
Yes.
It's like Catholic school handwriting, which is not the right side of the street. Michael's not so much. James Rollins, I hope I'm saying this right. Guilty Pleasure, Airport Thrillers, mix of thriller, science, secret organizations, the intelligence community. Always some ancient threat is on the verge of being unleashed and weaponized. Usually ancient warlord symbols. He likes that mythological kind of stuff. Okay. Mixed with the Founding Fathers. Pretty cool. I would actually look that up because I'm not reading Station 11. Okay. Mine is the most boring. Oh, wait. I forgot the pop quiz. Okay. Everybody can do the pop quiz.
There's a quiz.
There's a pop quiz.
My understanding, there will be no math.
Sorry. This celebrity major figure in life launched a book donation program some years ago in honor of a parent, and it was started in one state. Now it's in multiple states, Native American communities, and numerous countries around the world. And late last year, donated 100 million books.
Wow.
Largely to children, but not exclusively. So who is the celebrity? And I will give you, Tom, you have to play. I will give you four choices.
Okay.
Oh. Mike Bloomberg.
Okay.
Oprah. Big on books. Big on books. Dolly Parton. Love Dolly Parton.
Mm-hmm.
Bill and Melinda Gates.
Oh, Bill and Melinda Gates.
Dolly Parton.
I'm going to go with Dolly Parton.
Definitely. Ding, 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 ding. Yeah. Tom and Jamie win. Dolly Parton. And she started it because her father couldn't read.
Huh.
And so she started the program in honor of him. And before he died, he told her, which was not so long ago, he told her that this book program was the most significant thing she did in her entire life.
That?
Yeah. It's a very, very big deal. Okay. So
she's a soulful person.
She is incredible.
She's great.
I want to take DNA from Dolly Parton and Tina Turner, and we will solve all the world's problems and have a heck of a lot of fun. Okay, David, book about plagues, viruses, what you got?
I mentioned this book before, and but I still think it's relevant. And that's the Randy Schultz book and the band played on about the AIDS epidemic and how it started. And just more about how it's amazing to me that even in the face of what was an actual pandemic, right? An actual plague in our country, that people are still arguing over who gets the credit and who gets the vaccine and who gets the money. And it's like, who cares? You know, stop people from dying, you know? So it's a great read. He did a remarkable job and had access to all of the players at the beginning of this back in the '80s when it was not mentioned by politicians at all.
Awesome. Jamie.
I'm sorry. What was the question?
Oh, I didn't give you the homework either.
Just tell me
I didn't
the question,
give you homework. Books about plagues, but I'll do mine because it's kind of boring. But I'm going to do the Michael. Yeah. Michael likes to rearrange my questions because he's smarter than the rest of us, and he usually has better questions. So it's not a book. But in 2018, Bill Gates did talk about pandemics.
Yeah,
and he said, you know, he's out giving a speech, and he just said, "Look, people are worried about a lot of things in life these days, but they should be worried about the fact that developed and non-developed countries are not prepared for this and the likelihood," and he has facts and figures. And those. So he gave the speech in 2018. And then if you go to the Google machine, Tori's favorite, he has an article recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. He talks about what's going on now and what communities, large, small, individuals should be doing. And it's so smart and it's so solid and it's so common sense. So I would recommend anything by Bill Gates on pandemics. Okay, Tom, I didn't give you the homework, but do you have any good books on plagues? Go, man.
Hot Zone, which is not about Ebola, but a similar disease.
Yeah.
And the book is probably 15 years old, so it really caught.
And it holds up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah.
And if you haven't read it, of course, an ancient thriller, The Andromeda Strain, which was an early Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton died, right?
Yes.
Remarkable writer.
Yeah.
He was a doctor.
He was a medical doctor.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this book was early, and I think they have to go underground in some, you know, hidden place in Arizona or something, I vaguely remember, so they can be completely quarantined.
As they say on Capitol Hill, I would like to associate myself with the comments of the previous speaker.
Awesome. Okay. So a little bit of housekeeping. Thanks to Calvert Woodley. Everyone should go there. Stockpile. I'm not saying that's what people are doing there, but everyone should go. Please follow us, download us, review us. Those who have reviewed us on Apple iTunes, thank you very, very much because they're all very positive. Thank you, Claude, making everything happen. Michael, as I said, did run off to take care of the children, which she appreciates. David, a score? Do we have a score?
Down one, late third.
I can make it. Okay. Thank you, David, Jamie, Tom, Rosenthal. Thank you so much. Great to see you again, my friend.
Thank you. You're
holding up well. You are really holding up well. Okay, we're off next week. I did have a plague guy, a really good, really solid plague guy who wrote an interesting book, but he's busy, which is good. I think that's good because he's devoted to addressing these issues. But we'll be back on the 23rd. I've been trying to get a good YA author. Tom, do you know what that is?
Yeah, I got some YAs in my
good
family.
Young adults. Yep. Ah. Young adult author Zach Smedley. We'll be back with him. Thanks, everybody. Wash your hands. Jamie, take us out.
You've been listening to Chatter on Books, and as always, your comments are welcome. If you have a criticism, please remember what your mother said. If you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. See you next time.
Thanks, honey.